Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello and welcome to the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel, and today I'm interviewing the author of Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army, John P. Langelier. And his book is published by Schiffer Military History. I think you're going to enjoy this interview. When you listen to it, you'll see how knowledgeable John is. He's a longtime historical scholar of military history. And he's done a great job with this book here about the African-American soldiers known as the Buffalo Soldiers. So give it a listen, and I hope you enjoy. Hello, and welcome to the New Books Network. This is the African-American Studies channel, and I'm your host, James Stansel. And I have the great pleasure today of being here with military historian and author John P. Langelier. John P. Langelier. How'd I do, John?
Great job. I'm going to hire you as my new agent.
Okay. I just want to make sure because I was having some trouble with John's name before we went live, but he's a great military historian and a great author, so I wanted to, as much as I could, get his name correctly. And we're going to be talking with him on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network today about his recent book, Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army. Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army. And his book is brought to us today by our friends at Schiffer Military History. Schiffer Military History. So, John, thank you so much for taking some time with us today.
Well, it's an honor to be with you, James, and it's good to be back home. I've been on the road since March of 2016.
Oh my goodness.
With this book, deciding that rather than just sit here and build it and they will come, which is never true, I would not only go on the road to take the book out, but to visit many of the sites that I
awesome.
Deal with in the book. And frankly, I have learned as much from the audience as I think I have imparted to them. If I could only get a second edition of the book, it would be about twice as big from what I found on the road. So it's been a great ride.
That's wonderful, John. And I'm hoping that happens, that you do get a second edition. You know, and I just want to tell you, you know, I'm a great lover of books and reading and history, as you know, a history scholar myself. And your book was great. You know, just even outside of, you know, interviewing authors and stuff, I really enjoyed your book. The pictures and you know the great history and stuff in there. And I can tell that you spent a lot of time, you know, doing these things. And so, you know, thank you so much for bringing these African American soldiers of the past to life. You know.
Well, it was a pleasure, and it was a long, circuitous road to get there. I moved to Arizona, where I have now retired mm-hmm. after a career doing many things. And I essentially moved out here from a little French-Canadian farming community in Illinois to Tucson. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the minute you get here, you turned around from the life as we knew it south of Chicago to a whole different world of the, you know, and of course it was the heyday of Hollywood making TV shows that instead of CSI, NCIS, etc., was a Cowboy of the Night Club, if not multiple. But you never saw, in terms of these TV shows, with rare exceptions, any soldier or any cowboy, for that matter, mm-hmm. who was somebody who was a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant. Mm. And the only exception to that was a rare television show on that great series, Dick Powell's Zangre Theater, where none other than a fellow by the name of Sammy Davis Jr. plays a Buffalo soldier. And great role. You never think of Sammy, you know, in the light of Westerns and stuff, although he was literally one of the fastest draws on the planet. He loved fast draw. But that came and went. And so for the average person, whether it was watching TV, going to the big screen with John Wayne, or in our classroom, you didn't hear about people of color. There was certainly, if anybody was there, it was the Indians, and 99% of the time they were the evil menace. You know, and so the fact that the black soldier, the black cowboy, the black settler was really something that we did not hear about in any of the larger media, of course there was no social media in those days in the 50s and 60s, etc., or in our classroom space. And so I was woefully ignorant for many years until a book came out in the 1960s called The Buffalo Soldiers by Professor Bill Lecky. And Bill broke the mold and began to, in an academic world, to introduce folks to the topic of Buffalo Soldiers. And as with always situations with the pioneers, you don't always get it right the first time out of the chute, but he got it right enough that he inspired others. And there was another scholar who unfortunately never got his due, and a fellow by the name of Ted Harris, who did his doctoral dissertation back in the 60s on Henry O. Flipper. The still best book on Flipper, the one that if you were going to go to anything to start on Flipper, you have to go to Ted's work. But Ted's work was kind of hidden away because it was a doctoral dissertation, and God knows if you write one of those, you don't even want to read your own, much less get it out there for the rest of the world.
Yes, very true.
And so, Ted, they were the pioneers, and I kind of, grew up with those things. Not that I ever really grew up. I'm boasting. I'm still very childish. But I'm pretending that I'm going to grow up someday and find something that I can do when I do grow up. But in the meantime, I spent from the 1960s till 2 years ago in the public history field, both in the museum world and in the military history world, both for the U.S. Army and with the U.S. Navy. And as a consequence, what really got me back into the topic, having shelved it, was I was stationed in San Francisco protecting all of you people in this country from the godless communists coming over across the Golden Gate and taking care of America. So, 7 hard years there and some hard years in Hawaii, all those difficult and dangerous duty places, so that I have many hero ribbons. Yeah, right. I discovered a man that was absolutely, in many respects, the forerunner to one of our great heroes of our lifetime, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Okay. Well, there was a chaplain by the name of Chaplain Allen Ellsworth, who had been born into enslavement. And, of course, as many of you and your readers know, this was something you didn't go out one morning and say, I think I'll learn to read and write, because it would be punishable in heinous ways. But he was so incredibly intelligent. Not only did he learn the basics of the three R's, but after he served in the Civil War as a what would be equivalent to a medic, and the Army, went into the U.S. Navy, which was integrated in the Civil War, unlike the rest of society. He was a petty officer. He left the field through the Freedmen's Bureau and other things, went on to achieve great education. He had a master's degree in theology at a time contemporary with my own grandfather, who barely had a fourth grade education. This man was brilliant beyond all means. And he happened to be stationed at an all-white garrison in San Francisco on Angel Island, which is a magnificent state park.
Yes, yes.
To this day, and his chapel still stands. And you and I are going to go out and raise big money so we can restore that chapel.
Let's do it.
It should be a national monument. It's a national treasure. But with that, he was my reintroduction as I was in California. And then they saw the wisdom of transferring me to Germany for a while, and I met a brilliant young Air Force officer by the name of Alan Osher. And Alan had written his doctoral dissertation on blacks in World War II in aviation, not only the Tuskegee Airmen, but the larger picture. And while we were there in Europe for several years together, we wrote a biography of Allensworth, and that kind of got me started on the path of this present book. So that was the long way of introducing that. And finally, I also was able to find other things, a few other films that came out. The classic, of course, with Woody Strode, who was literally and figuratively bigger than life, and we became personal friends, Sergeant Rutledge.
But
when Sergeant Rutledge came out, I was a child, and that was too racy of a film for a young, Catholic boy. The Legion of Decency would have condemned me to hell, and the Jesuits would have been on my doorstep to take me off to exorcise me. So I never saw it on the big screen until later in life. But again, we were not shown that portrayal in a great sense until, thank God, Dr. King and others in the 1960s began to open up vistas for all of us. And with that, the March on Washington and Selma and other things, the black soldier became somewhat more of a household word. And the term Buffalo Soldier, which unfortunately is sometimes misunderstood and used for political purposes and other purposes, began to come to the fore and has many, many meanings depending on your generation or generation or depending on how scholarly you are versus how popular you want to be. But I'm not often popular because unfortunately I am spent too much time with the military and I don't believe in alternative facts. There are facts and then there are not alternative facts.
Okay. The views on this podcast are not necessarily those of the New Books Network. But all
no, they're not. You're off the hook. You're getting what you paid for, nothing, and you're getting nothing from me. No, quite frankly, your audience, as I had mentioned, is the audience that I have embraced on this tour after working on this book since literally in the back of my mind since the 1960s till the day I retired. I locked myself away and said, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of images and thousands of pages of real documentation, regrettably very few from the soldiers themselves. And so I said, I want to do something with this. And there's two or three better books in terms of literally being academically sound. The one that every one of your readers should read, of course, is The Black Regulars, 1866 to 1898 by William Dobek and Thomas D. Phillips. Tom wrote the introduction to my book or the foreword, and you can see it was fun and tongue in cheek. He takes no prisoners. He makes me look politically correct. And he showed up on my doorstep in the 1960s writing a doctoral dissertation again on a subject that virtually none of us had known about and helped open my eyes to the subject. Then, of course, the dean of all the people working on the black military experience in the West is Frank N. Schubert, or Mickey Schubert. Mickey has written such things as Voices of the Buffalo Soldiers, which has some of the few actual words of the black soldiers.
From the soldiers themselves.
Right? From the soldiers themselves, and then his Black Valor on the Medal of Honor, the Black Medal of Honor recipients from 1870 to 1898. And then, of course, his massive volumes called Trails of the Buffalo Soldiers, which are little snippets of information that he's gleaned over the years. Well, I took these ideas and said, you know what? I don't want to write for other academics. I have some credentials, but I'm not at the level of some of these people. I want to write for people like myself who maybe knew something about the subject but wanted to know more and make it an appetizer. So that's why the photographs, because the photographs allow our reader to literally look into the eyes of those men and the women who accompanied them, some extraordinary women who get their due. And say, these are real people. They're not plaster saints. They're not all these things that we sometimes read history. Oh, George Washington, the man with the square jaw and wooden teeth or whatever, the nonsense that we get in our minds. These are real people. They are the ancestors of many people who have been denied their past and their pride and who they are and where they came from. And I wanted to make it an accessible book so that people would learn to appreciate this and go on to other more solid academic works, or if not, at least have hopefully the joy of learning a bit more about the people. And so the book was divided up into, yes, you have to tell the military story of the bravery and the complexity of being a black soldier in a white West fighting American Indians, fighting Latinos. This was not a rainbow coalition. I wish that it had been, but this was America of the 19th century, and we can't apologize for it. It is what it is. And given the opportunity or lack thereof, especially after Reconstructions came crashing to a halt and that strange fruit hanging from a tree was more likely to be the case for a black man and occasionally a black woman in the South, it was time to go elsewhere. And while the Great Migration takes place later on, my argument is that the exodusters to Kansas and some of the Oklahoma area and the people we now refer to popularly as the Buffalo Soldiers began that great migration as a trickle before it became a flood. And we owe a great deal to them. And so we have the three black graduates of West Point of the time, of course, Henry O. Flipper being the first. 4 years of going to college without having anybody speak to you in any social terms other than formally come to the board, solve this trigonometry problem, or translate this Latin verse or whatever from Cicero. How we could get through that is beyond me. These men were heroes if they never stepped into the fray afterwards to survive that. And Flipper and Charles Young, of course, the last, and then John Alexander in between, who died tragically of a heart condition, very quickly died peacefully in a chair getting his hair cut at Wilberforce, one of the great schools of this country to this day.
HBCU.
Absolutely. And so we have these three West Pointers. We have the African-American chaplains, including Chaplain Theophilus Stewart, who wrote extensively on black soldiers, and for the first time putting things into print for, if you will, in a context from somebody who lived there. And his wife was his second wife. His first wife passed. His second wife was extraordinary. She was, to my knowledge, the first black woman doctor certified in the state of New York. Think about how black doctors there were in general in the post Civil War, and then to be a woman to step up. We're talking about people who we are standing on their shoulders. I mean, they paved the way for us, and the common soldier who we know so little about. This Medal of Honor recipients and those who don't receive the medal, but who do their duty and again enlist and reenlist. And this is not like the average guy who comes in off the boat from Ireland or the guy who's out of work in New York or whatever. It's a job of work. It becomes a profession of arms for these black soldiers who will enlist and reenlist and spend a career in the military, many of them, and will have the lowest desertion rates as well as the highest reenlistment rates in the Army of this era, where in some cases over 20%+ of the Army will desert in some years, but not in the black regiment. So these men took their job seriously, their profession seriously, not only for themselves, but I suspect that they really knew what impact there was on the black community and hopefully on the white community through the eyes of such guys as Frederick Remington, who was, like many of his peers, was a racist and would use the N-word, but came from doing caricatures as a young artist that no one knew to embracing the Buffalo Soldiers and indeed using the term in a major, major publication, the USA News of the time, if you will, the term Buffalo Soldiers, which helped popularize that term. But he didn't tell us where in the hell he got the idea from. He just uses it. But because of his illustrations and because of his writings as somewhat of an early day embedded reporter, country at large began to experience something that was not just the white generals who had been the Civil War officers who came west to do the bidding of the government and westward expansion. We began to look into the eyes of these men, and he began to see them as men and as ex-soldiers and some of the best soldiers in his short but incredible career he would capture in prose and in picture, and leaving us the better for it. And unfortunately, dying young himself, and his kind of window into that world, a fellow by the name of Powhatan Clark, whom hopefully we'll talk a little bit later, helped him view that window. And Clark was a Southerner, born in Louisiana, to a Confederate officer as a father, and probably was more, quote, in the liberal vein than most of the people of the time who professed a good, solid abolitionist and such. Yes, we want these people to be free. I just don't want them to live in my neighborhood or date my daughter. This was not the case, obviously, with Clark, who received the Medal of Honor and said blatantly in a letter to his mother, which is something that was never meant for publication, these soldiers are the finest soldiers in the world. I would serve with no other but them. And coming from a Southerner, you would have thought it would have had a different approach. And he ultimately went and studied the German army in the early 1890s and still came of the opinion that our army, our black soldiers, were amongst the finest, and came home to try and train those soldiers to be even better than they already were. So it's been an inspiring situation to read the words, and I literally just got back from reading his diaries, probably never opened except by Dr. Phillips and a couple of others since Clark's tragic, untimely death in the 1890s, a very young man. And read firsthand Frederick Remington's diaries, from going from, these are black guys, so what, to, oh my God, these are amazing, amazing men who I have to take my hat off to. And he will capture, as Dr. Phillips points out, out of his over 1,000, say about 1,200 illustrations dealing with the frontier and the West and stuff, about a 20% of those are of the black military experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've seen a lot of those myself.
Yeah, and he's the only individual, with the exception of a couple of obscure images from an author or an illustrator by the name of Rufus Zogbaum, a household word. You just think, oh, Rufus Zogbaum, yes, I have all his art. No one remembers
Rufus. No.
he was the pre-Remington, and he did one literally token image of black soldiers that we know of, and there were probably two or three other images. But Remington was the king of portraying the military in the West and the black military in the West, and giving that group of people the nameless faces names. And so that was the goal of this book, is to try and put names or at least faces to the individuals. And I now have sometimes names to those faces that I didn't have until I went out and found
a descendant
or a local historian who loved the topic and knew more about Fort Buford, South Dakota, than any living person on the planet. But you'd only meet them if you were at Fort Buford on a rainy day giving a talk to an audience of 12 or 14 people, and all the way up to audiences of 400 in Denver, Colorado, where it's been humbling for me and inspiring. And I'm praying that the book will go into a second edition, and the follow-on book, which is right now under the working title of Knight Errant, Powhatan Clark, Frederick Remington, and the Buffalo Soldiers, using their firsthand information that has been scattered to the four winds, and putting it all back together like an archaeologist or a detective has to do in a
or a great military historian.
Well, I don't know a great military historian, but one that I'm finally stoked about a book. I've written many books, but sometimes I fall asleep reading them and certainly writing. So if you have people out there in the audience who have trouble sleeping, at my age, I do. My books are the perfect tonic.
No.
And I have to also give a plug to True West Magazine, who Bob Bowes-Bell, who's a legend, truly not a legend in his own mind, but truly a wonderful legend, has the following. Bob encouraged me to go on this border-to-border Buffalo soldier tour, and I now know why publicists get paid big money, because the phone gets slammed down in your when you call, and your emails don't get answered, and it's been difficult, but it's been highly instructional for what somebody has to do to promote a book, not for the sake, in this case, of making a lot of money. The whole $1.50 I make a book on royalties is not going to pay for the phone call we made today, but it has been enlightening, and it's helped me understand how you get word out to the public.
Sure.
And made me think that the two documentaries that I did for the old A&E network, before the History Network was even around, I want to go back and do more. And the show that I did for PBS, for Love of Liberty, with Halle Berry as the on-camera host, whom they would not introduce me to. Can you imagine that?
That's horrible.
It is horrible, and I don't understand what the restraining order was about at all. That's another story for another time. Goodness.
Yeah, I actually have that in my collection, too, by the way, to let you know. I do have that in my collection, that DVD.
They did a great job on it. She was an outstanding choice. And the voiceover people, talk about people who made no money. You knew everybody who was on there was somebody who made more money in a day than you and I could make in a year. And yet every one of them did it for scale, which was pennies. And that tells us, once again, that we thank God not live in a different time than when these men and women were in the West, the Buffalo Soldiers, earning their spurs and creating a reputation, a well-deserved but not always lauded reputation or known reputation, that we are light years ahead of where we were, but we are not where we should be, I guess, is the other part of the story, as Paul Harvey would say, the rest of the story.
The rest of the story. Right, and we're here on the African American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I hope you're enjoying our conversation we're having here with the author of Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army, military historian John P. Langelier. And his book is published by Schiffer Military History. And, you know, again, John, thank you so much for, you know, spending some time with us and really taking the time, you know, through your research to do this book. And like you said, it's not necessarily going to be you know, the most scholarly book for people who, you know, who are looking for that heavy scholarship. But the images and the pictures, this is a great introduction for kids, for younger people, for maybe, like you said, the average reader, you know, an entree for them to get into the proud military history of African Americans, particularly those known as the Buffalo Soldiers from, 19th century, early 20th century. So I salute you, sir, for your great
work. Well, thank you, Ren. And also the most important part of the book besides the pictures is there is a good bibliography. So
yes.
It's the
yes.
Further reading. So if you want to go on to go from your undergraduate class here that I've just given you to your graduate work, you can then go read the bibliography. And frankly, you, as you well know, we have are blessed by two African-American dynamos that have started museums on the Buffalo Soldier. Mm-hmm. One, of course, in your area in Houston, and then there's one in Tacoma, Washington. And I've visited both. I've been blessed by speaking at both places over the last year and a half, amongst other places. And they both have no funding, and yet they carry and show the flag without heavy government subsidization. They get no government subsidies.
No.
Although we're attempting to get a grant at the one in Tacoma to write what will be a prototype of a 5th, 8th, and 11th grade studies materials.
Okay.
So that a curriculum guide, so if you're teaching at middle school or high school or whatever, you can use these curriculum guides for your students and to serve your students that perhaps did not realize that their pride should extend back a long ways in who they are, and also those who aren't African-American. It doesn't matter.
This is
not African-American history. This is not just military history. This is American history.
Absolutely.
And we have to keep that in mind.
Yes.
And the days of us compartmentalizing and segregating ourselves are, thank God, long past, and we need to look at pictures wholly as we step back, as opposed to up close like a mosaic. If you look at a chip in a mosaic, you don't see the picture.
Good way to think about it.
And Absolutely. So I'm hoping we'll do this. The people at the museum are working diligently to get this out. And if we can do this, that means we can clone it in Texas or Arizona or California or elsewhere and put the local information in with the broader topic and bring it literally home. That's the object of the drill. Bring it home to the young student. And in order to do that partially, too, my publisher has, for those of us who still – I have to have a book in my hand. I'm sorry if I don't have it in my hand. I have to touch that bus, dust jacket,
right,
and flip it and smell that new ink and things. But my book is now available through Shipper as an ebook also.
Oh,
so
okay.
I realize that is important for people who travel. I'm one of those guys who've literally driven to last year over almost 20,000 miles to all these Buffalo Soldier sites to speak. And I do books on CD, and they're a godsend. My book will never go on CD, but it is an E, unless you and I do the voiceovers and bring it to life. And actually, that's another thing. We're laughing. There's a book called by Elmer Kelton, who was an old journalist in Texas, as you're probably familiar with. Matter of fact, one of the best Western authors, and I'm not trying to demean other fiction authors of the Louis L'Amour ilk and such, but Elmer Kelton somehow could capture a topic and capture his audience. And he did a book that, if you read no other book fictionally, Wolf and Buffalo. It is a magnificent work, and it's actually been turned into a two-volume, rather than just the typical dulcet tones with a guy with a great voice like yours reading it. Everybody has a part, so they make you as the first sergeant, and I'm the old curmudgeon. It's an audio drama. It's like an old radio drama, and it is absolutely worth hearing as a radio drama or picking up as a book for good reading. It's not history, but it brings the some thoughts about what it must have been like in the post-Civil War era to leave the life of the plantation and start anew in a totally foreign place with a completely different way of approaching one's worldview. And so it's certainly worth your readers doing. It's one of those summer reading things that I would be taking on my tour to Skagway, where I'm going to be speaking on Buffalo Soldiers, believe it or not, in August, because the 24th Infantry helped maintain law and order in that wild and woolly Klondike gold rush era. And there's a place called And I know you and I need to go up there and make sure it's done right, but there's a place called the Onion Saloon. We would never go into a saloon, but, if we did, the Onion Saloon actually is comprised of the three buildings that were the Buffalo Soldier Barracks up there.
Wow.
Those soldiers must be smiling down on us going, wow, we've made it. Our barracks is a saloon. I mean, that's the ultimate. Now, when I grow up, I do want to be a bartender, so there you have it. These are things that, you know, many people don't realize in their own backyard, whether you have the great museum in Houston or the great museum in Tacoma or the wonderful sites like Fort Concho, one of my favorites in the charming town of San Angelo. You step back into time there or go to Kansas to Fort Larned, where I just recently spoke, and or go to the gravesite of some of the folks in El Paso in the who are in the Buffalo Soldier section of the cemetery there, the Concordia Cemetery.
Okay.
These people lived and died for a cause and for us as great Americans.
Right.
And boy, I didn't do them justice, but I keep trying. Hopefully, I will someday.
Well, you may not feel like you've done them justice, but you definitely got a great start down that road, John. Because you have a great book here, and like I said, it's a great, you know, entree or entry point for people who want to learn about these soldiers. You know, nice pictures, images, and like you mentioned, you know, the bibliography in there, you know all those different things that you have in there. I mean, this is a great. I think you underestimate what you've done here, John, a little bit. So kudos to you. And his book.
Well, I'm used to having books that come off the press and are remaindered immediately, so this is a different.
Right. Well, you know, you have a fan in me and in me.
Well, thank you. And I invite the readers too to go online for True West Magazine, where I've written a number of articles on many topics having to do with blacks in the West and other aspects of the Western military, particularly history.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of the images that didn't make it into the book came out right after I had the book go to print.
Oh, okay.
Colleague discovered a cache of glass plate negatives.
Ooh.
Of not only the soldiers involved 120 years ago in this incredibly interesting bicycle experiment. Hey, James, let's get on a bicycle. We've never ridden one virtually. Well, we're going to go from Missoula, Montana to St. Louis on nothing but railroad tracks and bad roads that are muddy. And that's only 1,900 miles, a good stretch of the legs. And we're going to make military history that everybody forgot about. But it was just something that was done at that time and, again, overlooked. And now we're coming up on the 120th anniversary, literally this month, of that monumental ride of troops. And these were glass plate negatives of some of the guys and some of the women involved in their life. And a colleague up in the Pacific Northwest found them and made them available to me. So they're on. In my article on the Buffalo Soldiers,
okay. True West Magazine,
True West Magazine, the June 2016 issue, because that was the actual 150th anniversary of the six Buffalo Soldier regiments, or the regiments we now refer to as the Buffalo Soldier regiments today, were created by Congress. So once in a while, Congress does good things, and we've got to remember that. You know, we've got to applaud those people and encourage them to continue in that vein. You know,
that would be what. The people would want, absolutely. The American people would want. And so we're here with John P. Langelier, the author of Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army. His book is published by Schiffer Military History. And we're having a great conversation here. John is telling us about some of his adventures he's gone on and things that he's seen and some of the great work that he's put in to publish this great book. And again, I highly recommend it, not only as a historian and a researcher, but as a person who, you know, enjoys good books. And this is certainly one for younger people or people who are getting introduced to Buffalo Soldiers. This is a good book, great images for you. And John puts out some great bibliography there and some reference areas for you to go in and find some additional works. He's mentioned a lot of them on this podcast too. So you're not only publicizing your book, John, you're helping some other folk, you know, who can get their research recognized as well. So kudos to you on that too. Can you maybe just tell us a little bit about just, you know, for people who may be getting into research or maybe, you know, kind of don't understand, you know, what it takes to do something like this. How did you go about, you know, finding, you talked about this a little bit where you've met people, different places that you've gone, but, you know, how did you go about putting a book like this together?
Well, first of all, if somebody has the idea that they want to do this, mm-hmm. it should be like AA. They should call a friend who's an author who can talk them out of this insanity. Because other than the author that we were talking about earlier offline who uh-huh. bastardized with my name in one of his novels, most people don't make any money on this. This has to be truly a labor of love. So you have mm-hmm. to disimbue yourself of making a lot of money. You may make a lot of friends, and I guess that probably would look better on your headstone. I wish I had more money. I think it might say, I wish I had more friends. We can never have that many. But to really answer your question, you have to really drill down. But one of the great things we have that we didn't have when I started this back in the 1960s and 70s kind of passively was we have a lot more things online. Now we have to be aware because, as we know, things that are online are not always, shall we say, vetted by people who know what the real story is. So sometimes, as they say in the old Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, when the legend becomes fact, print the legend. And so the legend is out there, and you have to be very careful about that. But we have something called Chronicling America, which is from the Library of Congress, mm-hmm. and they are newspapers. From not everywhere, not all time periods, but they're, each year they add more. And you can mm-hmm. take a time period. You can take a place. You're interested in Maryland. You're interested in Kansas, Chicago, whatever. So you can plug in numerous terms and use those newspapers. And while newspapers then and now are not always factual as we might want, they still give us a kind of a beginning starting place.
Okay.
The mother load, of course, is the National Archives, because the National Archives has all the records of these soldiers, whether they're their enlistment records, their retirement records, mm-hmm. All these things that are imperative. And one could spend a lifetime back there. And if I could have three lifetimes, I'm sure I could never do everything I want. But the National Archives is a phenomenal resource for your primary material. Sure. But every state, thank goodness, you can go to the state archives in Texas or Arizona or the state historical society. Sometimes they're joined at the hip, sometimes they're separate organizations, and find material related to your area that perhaps will never morph to the National Archives. Mm-hmm. I'll give you an example. I have an article coming out in Montana Magazine that I wrote another lifetime ago when I was tall and handsome and had dark hair. And played and was being scouted by the Lakers, because after all, my nickname is Dr. J, even though I'm only 5'4". You can imagine how intimidating I can be on the court.
Oh, man.
Yeah. So, and at any rate, I found that there were, in a chicken coop in Fort Assiniboine, Montana, somebody found the records of that fort.
Wow.
And there were materials that never made it to the National Archives that I used in this article, and that I'll use some subsequently in a larger study of the Buffalo Soldiers in Big Sky Country. Mm-hmm. Things like references, one amazing reference, one of the minor characters that I reference in the book, although he was certainly known better than most people, mm-hmm. a fellow by the name of John J. Black Jack Pershing.
Mm-hmm.
Pershing received his nickname in part because of serving as an officer with the 10th Cavalry.
Mm-hmm.
But I found a letter in these chicken coop handwritten documents where he was attempting to get out of the 10th Cavalry and go to a job that was for all whites in one of the Army support units, mm-hmm. meaning Quartermaster Corps, which would have meant you and I would have never heard of him, because a captain in the Quartermaster Corps was never going to become the commanding general of the U.S. Army and the Army, American Expeditionary Forces in World War I.
Right.
He was definitely a man of his time. He was not a friend to the black soldier, despite the nickname. And indeed, that letter kind of pointed to the fact that he was looking to get elsewhere because he thought maybe his career would do better not serving with the black unit. But what I'm finding in some of the other authors, I'll back this up, some of the earlier authors kind of started the legend that it was a stigma to be in a black unit. And the classic situation of George A. Custer refused a command with one of the black 9th or 10th Cavalry mm-hmm. regiments. Because he was, despite the fact that he was a northerner, he was more of a southerner in his thinking than Powhatan Clark, mm-hmm. who's, say, much more open-minded and he refused to serve because he was a racist. And I, it's just, you know, so many people at that time where it was like you can throw a stone and hit a racist, you know, mm-hmm. At this period of time. And it's blatant in this time. I'm not apologizing. I'm not naming. I'm just saying this is what it was. And Custer, thank goodness, went to the 7th Cavalry, so we don't have a lot of African-Americans buried on the battlefield up in Little Bighorn, thank God. A bunch of guys from Ireland and Germany and elsewhere are buried up there from the battle. Wow. But Custer was used as a – well, people didn't want to serve with the black units. Well, some didn't. But a lot of the officers, I'm beginning to discover as I'm doing this new book on Powhatan Clark, mm-hmm. their careers were equal, if not better, to – and including John J. Pershing, who was the highest-ranking officer until World War II, when, of course, we had the MacArthurs and the Eisenhowers,
sure,
et cetera.
Sure.
Didn't hurt his career at all. It was not an anathema to serve in a black regiment. And these guys got promoted the same way that others were promoted. And frankly, the legend of black soldiers getting the worst equipment and it's was also not true. We have more information showing that these guys are your top troops. So why are you going to handicap some of the best soldiers you've got, the best marksmen, the guys who are veterans of numerous campaigns, who have been in 20, 30, 40 years in uniform, and you're going to give them garbage? No, it's not true. I mean, that bicycle experiment is a classic example. That was the first and only big experiment in the U.S. Army for mobility, saying, hey, bicycles are cheaper than horses. For a lot of reasons, and a guy can roll into combat, dump that puppy, and go into fight, and you're not paying hundreds of dollars to maintain, feed, shoe, you know, all these kind of
things,
veterinary services, and a horse going to wear out. These army horses were not like the horses that the Comanches or others rode, where they could just ride them and ride them, because these were tough, you know, Mustangs bred on the plains or whatever down in Texas and on the northern plains, and so. This was a classic example of a white officer going to another white officer by the name of Nelson Miles, who became somewhat known for the last of the so-called Geronimo campaigns. And Miles, who had served as an officer in the Civil War with the U.S. Colored Volunteers or the Colored Infantry units that were raised over 100 regiments, cavalry, mostly infantry, but cavalry and artillery.
And
he said, go for it, kid. I think it's a good idea. So here's the most junior second lieutenant almost in the world with the top man in the army saying, I'm going to take my black soldiers, some of whom have never seen a bicycle, much less ridden them, and turn them into these buff guys that you wouldn't want to go into a gym and see because they'd make us look like, oh, my God, I feel, you know, like a, you know, fat old man, which I am. But they were in top shape. They were top soldiers. They were proud of it. And one of those photographs that my colleague found, here's a guy in a uniform that looked like he just stepped out of GQ, and on his collar, he's got a miniature gold bicycle. The Army didn't issue that. He went out in his crummy $13 a month salary, which was the average or was the starting salary for a private in the U.S. Army at this time, and bought something that might have cost him a month's salary because he was one of the guys. I'm one of the guys. I've got bragging rights. I want to show this since the Army's not remembering it. But that was a long way to get to the fact that the officers never – not necessarily found it discrimination, although Henry O. Flipper certainly was to use the parlance, he was shafted in many respects. Did he do some things that were he shouldn't have done? Yes, but tell me a second lieutenant in the world who hasn't made a mistake, and I'll tell you a second lieutenant who died before he was commissioned, because all young officers make mistakes until their top sergeants get them in under control and take care of their little baby second lieutenant shave tails. But Flipper's punishment did not fit the crime, one could argue. And if he had been a white officer, there would have been a different reaction. And it's the same way with the infamous 1906 Brownsville incident, where, the old strict teachers that some of us had as children, okay, one of you did something bad, since none of you will fess up, you will all be punished and stay in from research. Well, it was worse than that, obviously. An entire battalion will be left out to dry to never be able to reenlist. And one of them, Mingo Sanders, helped Theodore Roosevelt go up San Juan Hill, was instrumental, as a lot of the black troops were going up San Juan Hill with the Rough Riders, who most of them had never seen an enemy in their sights and had never fought in a real conflict. Anyway, Sanders was just a few months shy of his retirement, so he was denied his retirement and died essentially a pauper as a result of it.
Yeah, that's very sad.
We do have incidents of racism. Certainly it was there, but it was probably a more open society, again, than the sharecropper and the Klan and other things being experienced simultaneously in the Deep South. And certainly some of the army wasn't overt in its racism in the sense of not supplying them with the best that could be gotten at the time. And the best that could be gotten at the time was not necessarily great, but the white soldiers were getting the not necessarily great things at the same time, too. Mm-hmm. So it was a more complex story, and certainly it wasn't a story of being friends with the local American Indian tribes. There was one tribe that wanted no black soldiers near the reservation, used the N-word, and made it very clear not to send these buffalo soldiers into our neighborhood. Mm-hmm. So unfortunately, racism is learned. It's not inherent, and unfortunately, it was passed on to some tribal people who were not respectful of blacks. And so the idea that the name Buffalo Soldier came because of respect for this animal who was almost sacred to some tribal groups really is not, unfortunately, there's no evidence to support that. It might be true, but no one has shown the smoking gun that this is the reason why some Native American groups use that term.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and it's interesting that you say that, because, you know, you often hear that, then you also often hear that because, the skin, and they were darker, and, you know, those kind of things. So I guess from what you have found or not found, so to speak, you know, is that there's no evidence that it was any kind of honorary title.
No, the honorary part we cannot ascertain. We do know that for certain, because of several testimonies of people of the era, that it was, yes. We can conclusively say that certain Indian groups saw blacks and likened them physically to the bison that they had known.
Right,
but beyond that, but beyond the analogy of some physical characteristics that they offhandedly saw, because we unfortunately always categorize people when we're not them. We use titles and characterizations and such. So too did the American Indians, because they're no different than anybody else. They're real people. Of course, there's no such thing as an American Indian. It's just like saying European. What does that mean? You're French, you're German, whatever. Well, you're a Lakota, you're a Diné, which is a Navajo in modern parlance. And so, and there's no universal view of this. I mean, some extraordinary photographs of black soldiers who had American Indian wives. Mm-hmm. And it's like everything else. Racial prejudice or any kind of prejudice seems to go away once you seem to meet people who are your next door neighbor.
Right.
And once that mystery of them out there, whoever them is, and I would argue that was probably one of the great things that the black soldier did in the West. Mm-hmm. He introduced, in many cases, Montana and Arizona, for instance, had virtually no blacks until the black soldiers showed up by the hundreds in regiments, mm-hmm. and along with wives and families and others who came along, introduced certain places in the West to blacks for the first time. And it was like, these blacks come in the town, they're squared away, they don't start fights, they're not killing each other here, they're spending money in our town, and my God, there's good if not better than the white soldiers who had been here before them. And what was I thinking, and so a place
maybe
like
okay.
Missoula, maybe they're okay. In Missoula, Montana, literally, when the 25th Infantry, the main body that lived at Missoula, left, the town turned out to say their farewells. Not something you would have thought. So again, yes, was there prejudice? There was, but black soldiers helped break down racial stereotypes and barriers. And if they could have been other places, I think America might have been different earlier than it was.
Wow,
it wouldn't have taken until after World War II to start getting our act together and integrate. It's the what ifs of history. But I think, again, as Professor Rafer Logan said, before there was a Jackie Robinson or Ralph Bunch, there were the Buffalo Soldiers.
And yes.
My battery is going dead, but I guess that's a good sign that you should cut me off. Not my personal battery, my battery on my phone.
Well, I hope it was not your personal battery.
No. I've been assaulted and battered before, but it's not that one. I'm old, but I don't have a battery yet. It may be coming soon, and probably you've made it happen because you're tired of listening to me, and I wouldn't. I owe you a drink next time I'm in your area.
Oh my goodness! We're with the author of Fighting for Uncle Sam: Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army, published by Schiffer Military History, John P. Langelier. And we are gonna kind of get here close to the end. His battery is running down, so we can't talk with him forever. But we've definitely had a good conversation so far here, John. I wanted to give you the opportunity before you go, if you want to point our listeners in the direction of any other current research or future research that you have, or you've mentioned your True S articles, and that's awesome. They can look you up there. But please share with us briefly anywhere else they could find you.
You can obviously Google me and find other things that I've done. But the one that is out there right now that's kind of a pocket guide you can throw in your glove compartment is by Arcadia Books, and it's Military Outposts of Southern Arizona. It's the kind of thing you can go to Fort Huachuca, which if anybody is interested in the black soldier experience, Fort Huachuca does one of the best jobs in the country. Of trying to portray the black soldier in the West.
Okay.
And so there's the Arcadia book on Military Outposts of Southern Arizona. There's the new book I'm working on, and I'm hoping I live long enough to get it done because I'm getting excited about it. And that's the one on as I say, working title, which I hope next year we'll have this conversation.
Sure.
And it will be on the Knight Errant, Powhatan Clark, Frederick Remington, and the Buffalo Soldiers. And it's kind of looking through the lens of Remington and his art and how he begins to unravel the mystery of who these people are that he never even thought of, much less knew, and how Clark is kind of his guide, and Clark's untimely death about a year into his marriage and a little baby who is just born dies tragically. It's one of those things, if we made it into a miniseries, everybody would go, my God, this is worse than Downton Abbey. I'm going to cry every episode. And it frankly should be made into a miniseries because we need to explore in a context of popular culture what we have been doing brilliantly by people like Doboc and Phillips and Schubert and Lucky before them. I think popular culture sometimes can get to things, as I intimated in the book by Omer Kelton, that we in history can't, because we can't find facts to substantiate. We can speculate, but we can't substantiate, and that's frustrating for a historian. As soon as somebody invents a time machine, I'm the first guy volunteering to go back.
All right. Make sure you
besides
have
that
your,
you can
make sure you have
you
your
can tell I don't have any
though,
technology
John.
Anyway. I'm a 19th century guy. I can't even keep my phone plugged in.
Yeah.
So
that's okay. I would love to go back in time with you, but we would definitely have to have some rechargeable batteries for you, John, because we want you. Fully up and at 'em for the entire time travel mission. Well, thank you so much, John, for sharing your time with us. It's been fun. It's been great getting to know you. And yes, absolutely, we'd love to get you back for your next book on the African American Studies Channel, the New Books Network. And you know, hopefully, and everyone out there, you know, listening or watching, go out there and buy Fighting for Uncle Sam, so we can get this second edition with all these great new. Things that John has found in it. And next time you come to Houston, John, you definitely got to come through. We'll have some lunch, or we'll chop it up somewhere, as we say locally here, have some fun. And I'm actually going to talk with you offline about coming back and being involved in one of my book forums as well. Again, the book Fighting for Uncle Sam: Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army, John P. Langelier, the great military historian. He probably said, I'm not great. Yes, you are, John. You are a great military historian. Do not underestimate your skills and talents. Over, 40, 50 years you've said in the field, working as a military historian. He served in the military. He's a great scholar. You know, I'm going to give you your credit, even if you don't want to give yourself your credit, John. How about that?
Well, thank you, sir. And all I have to say is it's been an honor, and I have bow tie envy. You got to send me that great green bow tie for St. Patrick's Day.
Absolutely. We can work on that. And so we're going to close out here. John, if you can tell my audience goodbye, and I guess if any of them read the book and they have some additional items or something, like you said in your speaking engagements, if they want to get back in contact with you and help you with some of your research, they can do that as well.
Yes, sir. As a matter of fact, you broke the code and went to my publisher to get my email address, but it is. So that tells you Bill Moyer isn't the only guy that gets good stuff and drills down for the story.
Right.
I'd love to hear from people at my email address is my initials, JPLHIST51@gmail.com. So that's okay. JPLHIST51@gmail.com. I love to hear from the readers, some of whom have, as I say, I've learned as much from as I hope I've imparted to them. And I continue to learn because life is a journey. And all I have to say is, in closing, is of course, the motto of one of our great Black Cavalry regiments, ready and forward.
That's right, ready and forward. And you go forward with your work, John P. Langelier, and keep doing those great things, you know, as a military history scholar. And again, thank you for your work that you've done with the Buffalo Soldiers and African-American soldiers in general. You know, I think you underestimate the things that you've done, John. And this book, particularly Fighting for Uncle Sam, I think is going to be a great entry point for many because of the great work that you've done. And so your work will live on for generations. So thank you so much personally for me as an African-American male for the great things that you have done. Thank you, sir.
Have a great weekend.
All right. And on that note, we're going to let John go, recharge his batteries up, and we'll see him next time on a future edition of the African-American Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, James Stansel. God bless, and we'll see you next time. Peace and love.
Okay, we're back here on the New Books Network, the African American Studies channel. I'm your host, James Stansel. I hope you enjoyed the interview with John P. Langelier, the author of Fighting for Uncle Sam, Buffalo Soldiers in the Frontier Army, published by Schiffer Military History. It was great meeting and talking with John. He's a very dedicated historian when it comes to African American soldiers and military history in general. Hope you enjoyed the interview, and definitely get in contact with him. If you have any information that you can think could help him in his research about African-American soldiers. And also, we're definitely going to get him back on the show for his next book about the artist Remington and his representation of the Buffalo Soldiers. So take care, have a good day, and we'll see you next time on the African-American Studies channel of the New Books Network. Peace and love.